ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming. We did try to stay weekly. The news said no. So 5 days a week it is. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doog, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every year, around the first week of March, Sydney erupts in a celebration of rainbows, movement, and glitter.
Around 200,000 revelers line the street to support the 12,500 participants who sashayed their way up Oxford Street to take part in one of the world's biggest celebrations of LGBTQI pride.
It's a protest and a celebration. But there's a paradox to Sydney. It's been an oasis for LGBT people, that's lesbian, gay, bisexual and trans people, for many, many decades. But it's also known worldwide as the home of a particular kind of traditional, and some would say conservative, Christianity. Hi, I'm Rowan Salmond, and this is Soul Search, the show about how we make and find meaning. As you might imagine, Sydney's dual identity doesn't sit comfortably. There's tension, and sometimes outright hostility, between these churches and the LGBT community. But they're not entirely separate. Some LGBT people grow up in churches that teach that changing your gender or engaging in same-sex relationships is a sin. Then, as these folks come to know themselves, they need to decide what to do about it. Steph Fenton is one of these people and one of the original founders of New City Church in Sydney. They're also the author of Gender Expansive Faith, a book about Christianity and the trans experience. Hi, Steph.
Hi.
Take me back to Steph as a child. Who was little Steph? Paint me a picture.
Yeah, I grew up in a regional town called Tamworth in New South Wales, the country music capital of Australia, is its kind of name to fame. I was at a public school in a kind of outer suburbs of that town, also involved in church. My dad was my local minister. I was a sporty kid, played a lot of sports, and yeah, I think that's a little intersection of me.
Yeah. So your dad was your church minister?
That's right, yeah. In our local Anglican church, my dad was the Anglican minister. Mm.
And what was the rest of your family like?
So my mum is in my family. Then I had two older sisters. My older sister, she's passed away actually and had a significant disability. So that was quite a forming part of our family unit, as well as, I guess, living quite close to the church at some points in our life, and Dad often had visitors dropping in from the church, and we were very much at the centre of that community. I think those were two kind of big formative things that were part of our family structure. Lots of, I guess, strong values of kindness and looking out for maybe someone who might be doing it hard. I think that came both from having a sibling with a disability as well as being Christian and being part of the church. I guess that's a little bit.
Yeah. And what else did you learn as part of that church community? What were the values and things that they instilled in you?
I think it was a little bit mixed because I had someone in my family who could never kind of tick the boxes of the main narrative that I heard at church, that you kind of confess that you are a believer and then you are saved, and that kind of black and white sort of version of salvation. I had a sibling who actually couldn't fulfill that narrative. And so there was always a lot of complexity. Mm. And I guess those two things were there sitting alongside each other, that, you know, faith was quite, there's the kind of traditional salvation. You're kind of in and saved and part of the Christian faith, but also this kind of grayness as well. Also, there were, you know, things that I absorbed just from being in the community, comments that were made about gender and sexuality. So there was never a woman who was a bishop or the lead minister, and that was kind of talked about as if like women can be pastors, but they can't exactly be the lead pastor because there should always be a man. And I remember someone asking their mom a comment like, oh, is Gary gay? And I don't know if it was Gary, you know, but is Gary gay? And so their response being, no, he's Christian, so he's not gay. So there was, you know, there was a little bit of this beautiful kind of mystical kind of God in the grey and breaking down boxes, but then also, yeah, some kind of strict ideas that complemented my kind of absorbing in that community.
And so you, I mean, the church community, it's sort of more in the evangelical stream of Anglicanism.
That's right, yeah. And Tamworth was, I guess, Sydney Anglican light.
Okay.
Like it was within that stream, but not as extreme. So it was really when I moved from Tamworth to Sydney to study that then I really entered this very, yeah, I guess like kind of contrastingly and confronting sort of black and white sort of views.
Yeah. Can you give me a sense of, you know, in a nutshell, what Anglicanism looks like? Because it's very, very broad, and we've already sort of talked about like Sydney Anglican light. Like, what does that mean? What does that look like?
Yeah, and the Anglican Church broadly across the world looks very different in different places, but there are largely maybe two versions of the Anglican Church, if we're going to simplify it, one of which is higher, more traditional, might seem more like a Catholic church where there are people dressed up more in robes and incense, some more traditional liturgy. It might be kind of a very similar service week in, week out where prayers are sung or, you know, maybe some the organ is there playing hymns, more liturgical. And in Australia, the way that I guess like Australia was colonised by the Church of England, the Anglican Church, that there are more, that side of the church is more inclusive of LGBTIQA plus people, and they are the ones who have advocated for the ordination of women. So that's kind of the higher Anglican side of the church. And then there's this more evangelical church that sort of in response to this higher Anglican church wants things to be less liturgical, less about the rituals, because it's about really, really having a personal experience of salvation and faith. And they kind of viewed these rituals as being performative. Mm-hmm. But they're also the part of the Anglican Church that have, I guess, maybe more strict views of gender. So they don't ordain women. They're often advocating against the inclusion of LGBTIQA plus people, and often sort of have that kind of goes along with strict kind of definitions of who can be a Christian and who can't and who is saved and who isn't. So very simplified, but those are the two kind of parts of the Anglican Church, particularly in Australia. But obviously there are people who kind of traverse the middle ground as well.
Yeah, take very seriously the Protestant value of like sola scriptura, like the idea that the things that you believe should be based on the Bible only.
Yeah, that's right. And therefore, inherent in that is more of a heady faith as well. So it's a lot about the ideas and the defense of the faith as well. And often the body and desire and, you know, anything that you might feel or emotions is cast as, you know, evil in a sense of leading you astray from God. So, yeah, anything that's kind of experience-based is often refuted. So, yeah, for these ideas of the faith.
Mm. Growing up in that environment where, you know, your disabled sibling maybe wasn't as easily accepted, you heard these things about what women can and can't do, absorbed ideas about gender and sexuality that you later came to disagree with. I mean, why did you stay? What kept you in that community?
Yeah, I think it's different for different people, but for me, my faith really did save me in a sense, or like help me survive those harmful beliefs about me when I really in my 20s was coming to recognize that I couldn't change this part of myself of being queer. You know, at the time I identified as gay, and it was the core beliefs of my faith that helped me overcome the discrimination, the harmful things that were being said about me at the time. You know, scriptural verses of nothing can come between you and God, and Christ has done everything for you, that grace is universal, that these things are not conditional. And so therefore, when I was hearing that, you know, to be part of the church or to believe or to even have a relationship with God, that there was a condition put on that, that I couldn't be part of the church anymore. It was my faith that actually helped me realize that's wrong, and that what's happening here is not something that's divine, that it's human. You know, you can use the Bible to really advocate for a very harsh, exclusive form of faith, one that's very colonial or violent. I think you can also use the Bible to find endless mercy and forgiveness and grace and kindness and justice. And I think that was the part of my faith that I was drawn to, and which helped me contrast what was happening to me as kind of not Christian after a little while.
But why didn't you find another community that was more accepting of you?
Yeah, I did eventually. I think this is the hard thing about the way belonging works, and I guess fundamentalist Christianity as well, is that your whole identity is part of that community, and as well these ideas of potentially going to hell or having, you know, eternal time in separation from God. Those are the threats of leaving that community that feel so real and harsh. And it's a lot of what I guess people experience after being part of these faith communities and churches that are more fundamentalist, is a lot of like religious trauma, that these beliefs are caught up and everything you kind of identify with really is hard to detangle. So while I say that those things helped me survive, it wasn't instant. It was over years that I unraveled these beliefs and then learnt to kind of love myself and accept myself, and to see the, you know, my queerness as not being something that was against God, but something that could be, you know, express divinity and express the divine. So yeah, I guess I was in there for a while. And of course I wanted to speak back to the harm that was being done. I saw so much of my community being, all these things being said about us that I was like, this isn't true. Like, I want to share another story. That's not me. That's not my friends. And it took a while to realize, you know, people would say like, yeah, we're listening, or please tell us more. But at the end of the day, there was no change ever. I was never invited to kind of be part of conversations when they happened at church. And I realized, oh, this is all just lip service. So I guess it took me time, but I did eventually get out of there and find beautiful spaces where other LGBTQ+ Christians were gathering together and communities were forming and wonderful affirming churches. Yeah.
Mm. And that process of loving and accepting yourself, I mean, I imagine there's also a process of learning about yourself, which in that environment must have been a challenge. How did you find the language to describe yourself in that kind of spiritual landscape?
Yeah, I think there was a really formative time when I met my first gay friends. And I remember kind of silly pastoral advice. One minister said to me, I think you'll be okay as long as you don't move to Newtown. I was like, you know, thanks for giving me that piece of information, because I'm going to move to Newtown, you know, next year. So I met queer friends that didn't have this baggage about themselves, and I could see it differently, like lived out in their life, that you can be a gay person, a queer person, you know, however you identify, a trans person, and, you know, not see yourself as being something negative or unnatural, that actually there's something really beautiful about this. And I do think now it's the gift of the queer community that shows us really divine values very strongly. Like, they're often very accessible, very advocating for those who are marginalized, often very thoughtful about how spaces are structured. People don't kind of get easily easily categorized, or there are no assumptions made about people. And this is a real queer ethic that really aligns with the divine ethic.
Mm.
And then you went on to co-found your own church. Tell me about New City Church.
That's right. It was a beautiful community. There were five of us, all queer Christians of different kinds, who got together. And I guess we'd seen a lot of the Sydney inclusive churches were a little bit more liturgical. So they used a kind of more traditional liturgy or songs and music. And really we're craving a space that was more like the evangelical churches we'd come from. And so, yeah, it was more about the form of church. We had a lot of people who identified within the queer community, a lot of loved ones of people who were queer as well. And I guess we kind of had a fluctuating community of, on a Sunday, maybe there was about 30 to 40 people who might be there. But there was kind of this floating community of maybe 100 or so who were connected in, who might drop in week in, week out, or month in, month out. Yeah, so people were just really trying to find a lifeline to connect with others like them.
Steph Fenton is a speaker and pastor and author of Gender Expansive Faith. I'm Rowan Salmond, and this is Soul Search on ABC Radio National. As Steph came to understand themselves better, they first came out as gay, then later as trans and non-binary. Those coming out experiences both happened in church contexts, but in very different kinds of churches.
Very different, because I came out as gay in one of the Sydney Anglican churches that I was part of, and I was excluded from communion when I first had my first girlfriend there.
Oh, they wouldn't give you communion?
Yeah, yeah. It's quite common that people experience that, which is really awful. It's to kind of visibly show that you're out of communion. And I guess these are kind of part of those beliefs or practices that I was able to see were not okay, because actually no one can, you know, mediate between, you know, me and God. I don't think that's, you know, that's kind of how my faith and firm faith saved me, I guess, through those things, as I could recognize them as, I don't think that's right. That's wrong. But yeah, so that was my first experience of coming out as gay. It was awful. And then I came out as trans at New City Church, and it was just, oh, you're using they, them pronouns? Great. Okay, we can adjust our language. You know, we've all done this for other people in our community before. Like, we're all familiar with this. We can do that. Or, oh, okay, yeah, you are going to explore, you know, changes to you hormonally and then take some time off for top surgery. None of that was ever something that came into, can I be part of this faith community or not? And it was also something that added to my faith, even, that I got to lean into. And I guess a lot of people get taught that they have to interpret the Bible from a certain person's point of view. So from generally a white cis het man's point of view, that's the history of who has interpreted the texts and kind of given us the story and what it means. When I was at Bible College, actually, at a really inclusive ecumenical college in Melbourne, in NAM, University of Divinity, I was first shown that different people bring their lived experience to interpret the text. So therefore, as a queer or trans person, I can do the same. Like, that's actually an added value, not something that takes away from the interpretation of the Bible, is actually to bring alternative experiences and have a conversation. It was like, oh, I can lean into this, and it might actually add value to my faith. It might be a gift to offer, which was very different to anything I'd kind of embraced earlier in my life.
Now, you've used a whole lot of language there which may not be familiar. Can you just unpack, what do you mean when you say cis?
Yeah, so to be cisgender is that your sex that you're assigned at birth, so often it's male or female, but can be something else, aligns with your gender identity. So you were assigned male at birth and you feel yourself to be a man, or you were assigned female at birth and you feel yourself to be a woman. Those things align, and cis just means on the same side of.
Right. And so kind of the opposite, if you could put it that way, of cis is trans.
Yeah. So to be transgender is literally that the sex you're assigned at birth doesn't align with the gender identity you feel. So I was assigned female at birth and I don't feel myself to be a woman. I feel myself to be, you know, gender fluid or kind of in the middle somewhere. So I'm trans because it doesn't align.
Yeah, right. So you do not identify as a man or a woman, but that doesn't mean you're not trans.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I think there's all kinds of ways to be trans. It just means that you literally don't identify with that sex at birth, but you could still, you know, identify within the binary. You could be a trans man or a trans woman. Mm. You might not want to be called a trans woman. You might just want to be called a woman or a man, you know. So this is where our language is kind of catching up with experiences. And I think we're just really coming to understand the diversity of humanity and how we've squashed people into two categories and two boxes.
Yeah. You also use the word queer, which is, I mean, some people don't like that word, but what do you mean when you say queer?
Yeah, I think queer can just be like the not expected or the not normal in inverted commas. I guess it, we can use queer for identities for humans, people who kind of don't meet our expectations of what we think to be regular or normal. I think, you know, anything can be queer as well, you know, in kind of university, this theory of being queer can just be something we don't expect or something that's outside of a box or different to the regular. I guess it came from being a slur. It was usually a slur against gay men, but it's become something that also a lot of younger generations have reclaimed and find a lot of, I guess, empowerment in using. And, you know, queer is just something that encompasses my experience of sort of having an experience outside the norm of sexuality or gender or sex.
Mm. How do people in the queer community react to you as a Christian or a former Sydney Anglican? What do people say?
I think people are trepidatious, and that's for really valid reasons. The church has largely been really harmful against our communities, and so I think people can be cautious to know, oh, you're a Christian. That often means, you know, these other things, and that means this thing about me, but also I'm a bit confused or maybe curious because you're also trans. And so, you know, that you're hopefully not someone who is exclusive of trans people. So I think there's a mix of maybe cautiousness, but also curiosity and often celebration. People are so stoked that there are still people who are able to stay in their faith and their spirituality and see that as a real human right.
Hmm. A lot of people who are in your circumstance leave their faith for their own well-being, can't do it anymore. What made you stay? Why are you still a Christian?
I think it's an unexplainable question to answer, and I get asked this a lot. I think people leave because they have to survive, as you say, because there is no other safe option. For me, for whatever reason, I have kept on to my faith, which is just an unexplainable thing, really, though my faith has really evolved as I have evolved as a human. And I guess there are values that are part of my faith that I resonate super strongly with, the values of kindness and advocacy. You know, the Holy Spirit is, you know, in the Greek known as the advocate, this person who advocates for justice and mercy. I think those values are really the things that I find meaningful and essential and a core to who I am and who I want to be in the world is to be honest and kind and loving and create a world that is better tomorrow than it was today, to heal and transform things through softness. That's just things that I still thoroughly resonate with and I'm thoroughly drawn to and connect to and want to live out in my own life. And it's a worldview that I want to believe in and that I hope in as well, is that things can be better and, there is a hope for tomorrow if we can get together and instill these things together.
Hmm. How much of your Sydney Anglican identity do you think you've retained? How does it inform your faith today?
I think it has given me probably a cherish of the Bible more so than maybe other traditions. And I think also as a Sagittarius, I was born in the month of December.
That doesn't sound very Sydney Anglican to me.
Obviously, it's a mix. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, Sagittarians are very kind of scholarly, apparently. So I think I'm kind of drawn to this academic or scholarly sort of tradition that maybe my evangelical Sydney Anglican roots sort of have given me as well. I think I do love to reclaim the Bible passages that particularly have been used in harmful ways. And it's what I've done in my book, Gender Expansive Faith, particularly around this passage of Matthew 19, 1 to 12. And I can talk a bit more about that if you want. Mm. And then I think these kinds of core doctrines, particularly of grace, but I would say a lot of my faith has evolved, and it probably, you know, I always laugh about how if Steph 15 years ago met Steph today, I think Steph 15 years ago would be very terrified and confronted with Steph today, because I think they would think I've given everything away and I'm no longer staying faithful. But I see it the opposite now as I look back, like this, the version of faith that I have now that is able to kind of hold both. And I guess that's a lot of what my gender identity has given me as well. You know, I kind of live in this sort of mix of male, female, or in between, or fluidity that, you know, I've come to really celebrate in myself. And I've seen that as something that is really amongst my faith as well, is this fluidity. You know, often the Bible contradicts itself. So we could see that as something that confronts the reliability of it, or we could see it as something that is just part of the tradition. Mm. And something that's intrinsic to the Christian faith is to hold complexity and contradiction at the same time. So yeah, it's a bit of a muddled answer, but I guess I've kept some of it, but a lot of it has grown to be different.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk about some of that theology in a little bit, but can I ask you about your gender journey?
Yeah, so there are moments that I talk about in the book about things that sort of were always there. So there's this moment of when I was 3 or 4, maybe, I can't remember exactly how old I was, but it's one of my earliest memories when I was praying with my dad one night. We would often pray before bed. And afterwards, I just asked, "Hey, Dad, is it possible to be a boy when you go to heaven? Or would it be possible for me to be a boy when I go to heaven?" And I don't really remember his response. I more remember the question that I asked. And I think he said something kind of very kind of affirming but non-conclusive. But that was a question that I had. That's one of my earliest memories, is thinking like, maybe I'm not female. And, you know, the first time someone asked me my pronouns, I remember really feeling locked in to she, her, and that was like suffocating or restrictive, and that was a new experience for me. I'd never, you know, I'd never been invited to actually choose my gender. Like, what pronouns do you want to use? That's so foreign. And like little kind of gifts along the way of where people kind of helped me or kind of nudged me in this direction of really being able to accept something that I think was there from deep down long ago. I remember in high school, I was just like, oh, I just want to wear what the boys are wearing. You know, I was always a sporty kid. I was always playing with the boys, not with the girls. You know, in uni, people would say like, Steph, you're one of the boys and one of the girls. Like, you manage to kind of hang out in these two spaces and fit in. And so I think, yeah, there's lots of that has just been part of my life. But then getting language of, you know, trans, non-binary, genderqueer, like these kinds of fluid experiences of gender, or being able to kind of choose where I exist, really were helpful for me. And then also with my relationship with my body, I felt a lot of discomfort around how my body looked, particularly my chest having breasts. You know, I talk about, you know, during COVID, me and my housemate watched reruns of Survivor, and I would just subconsciously identify with male torsos and think that I had that myself. And then I'd go to get changed into my pajamas and then be like, oh, whoa, no, I still have like breasts on my chest. Like, that's so weird. I'm so shocked by seeing those. And it's an odd experience to try to explain, but I guess that was kind of, yeah, that was kind of my kind of knowing of being something different and wanting my body to look differently, or experiencing it internally. Like, when you close your eyes, how do I see myself? It's not as the world sees me, and it's not in the body that I currently have. So I guess that's a bit about my gender journey.
Yeah, I mean, bodies and our relationship to our bodies is pretty tough at the best of times, but you're describing something even more than that. You're describing how you, how would you put that into words?
I think it's just a deep knowing of who, a deep knowing of who I am that's different to how I'm being described or seen by others or even just, you know, in myself. This thing is just a little out of alignment. I talk a little bit about how it's like finding, you know, the final puzzle piece to a puzzle and something clicks. There's something that just aligns when you find a word, when you're given access to hormones or surgeries, you know, things just click for you, you know, and that, I think that's my experience. You know, what even is that? Like, it's such a kind of funny experience.
Would it be fair to say that you started life as a girl, or is that not how you see it?
I think that I have lived as a woman is what I would say.
Yeah.
And I've had that socialized experience of being, I guess, treated and reflected as a girl and as a woman in the world. And those, I think those are parts of my experience that I feel really strongly connected to, particularly because of the way the world genders everyone and the way that the world genders people unequally. So the fact that, you know, I often had experiences where men were put forward for leadership or told that they could do something, but I couldn't. You know, those are things that I don't want to lose access to having had that lived experience. But I would say that this is always who I have been as well. You know, I've always had this internal feeling of feeling a little bit just not like this is the right space for me. Like there's something that's just a little bit off. So I think maybe both are true at the same time.
Hmm. And why do you think for someone with your experience of gender and your gender identity, people react negatively to that?
I think coming back to these two strict categories that generally inform our what we see to be as normal. In the church, that was, we were told that these, you know, to be male and female, these are the two categories that are created by God, designed by God, they're natural. In the world, you know, if you're not someone of faith, you'll largely have been socialized within this framework as well, that, you know, people are one of two categories. And those categories are very strictly defined. And, you know, this is in my book, I talk a lot about these ancient gender norms that, you know, we, a lot of which we have today, they're very consistent across time and space.
Yeah, I mean, the Bible kind of has this underlying assumption that there's only two genders and there are different roles that are assigned to men and women. I mean, like, how have you grappled with that over the years?
Yeah. I mean, firstly, just to answer your question, I think that people are antagonistic towards trans people because we disrupt those norms, and there's something that they are taught to fear about us in this gender binary system. And so I think that's what we're seeing happen in the world today is like this, you know, in a gender binary, people can't be anything other than man or woman. And so we fear and stigmatize people who are beyond that. But yeah, I think through the Bible there, you know, a lot of trans and queer people have reread Genesis and this creation story that's, you know, in the form of a poem. I don't think that this story was ever meant to talk a lot about gender and sexuality, but because a lot of people interpret it in this way, I think queer and trans people have responded with alternative readings of that text. I think it's a poem that's a set of merisms. Merisms are, you know, two words that describe a whole. So if I say I look high and low for my sunglasses, it doesn't mean I look in the highest point and the lowest point, and then I don't look anywhere else. It means actually I literally looked everywhere. So I looked everywhere for my sunglasses. I looked high and low. So then, you know, when God creates in this set of merisms, you know, there's day and night, there's land and water, there's sea creatures and land creatures. And so it's this division. It seems like a division. And then it comes to male and female. And it looks like it's two binaries, but actually they're mirrors. mannerisms. They're talking about, you know, day and night. It doesn't discount dawn and dusk. Those things are in between. And, you know, these are queer readings of the text that I actually think are more true to what it is saying, to kind of discount dawn and dusk. We often think they're the most beautiful parts of the day, and actually where most people connect with divinity or can be awe-inspired or have kind of a sacred connection to those parts of the day. But, you know, they actually aren't created in the Genesis text. So then when we get to male and female, we can read it very consistently with the rest of the text and go, okay, male and female and everything in between, this spectrum of gender. And I think that really applies very consistently to how God is described and the divine is described throughout the Bible is, you know, it's he who nurses us at her breast, you know. There's often he, she pronouns used for God. God is a mother hen. God gives birth to the people, but then also is father, king, you know, this kind of masculine and feminine imagery.
Mm.
So it's actually, I think, more consistent to read the Bible in a gender expansive way.
Why is it important to you that the Bible affirms your gender? Because not everybody cares about that.
Yeah. I think because for so long, the Bible has been used to discount gender expansive people, to discount the existence of trans people. And that's what we're seeing across the world at the moment. You know, what's happening in the States and, you know, Donald Trump being elected very much with the support of the Christian right. You know, a lot of kind of strongly reaffirming this binary view of gender, which wasn't existent in a lot of Indigenous communities. It's kind of come in with this the colonization and, you know, the interpretations of the Bible on these communities is to have a gender binary. And I think because the text has been used in these harmful ways, I really do want to reclaim it. And I think for me, it's important that God does affirm who I am, that I'm not wrong, that to be who I am is actually accepted. It's not the things that have been said about me to be unnatural or something that's evil or fallen or sinful. You know, those are all the things that I have been taught in my past. But to actually see that to be gender expansive is actually to show a really beautiful quality of God and the divine, you know, that forgiving yet also holding accountable. These two kind of contradictory ideas are about God. Like, God is kind of across the binary. And so for me as a gender expansive person, that I reveal God and I reveal something beautiful about God, about being outside the binary, this alternative energy and movement of God into the world, will actually help resurrect and transform and uplift, that it kind of saves in this way. You know, I think to see my experience align with that story is really important for me.
Mm.
On Soul Search on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and ABC Listen. I'm Rowan Salmond and I'm speaking with trans non-binary author Steph Fenton about their experience of coming out at church and what it means to be queer and Christian at the same time. Steph is now based in Melbourne but was one of the founders of New City Church in Sydney. We'll have a link to Steph's book and other information in the show notes for this episode on the Soul Search website. As a former Sydney Anglican, reading and interpreting the Bible is still really important to Steph. In their book, Steph argues that a particular passage in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 19, allows for what they call gender-expansive faith.
Essentially, the Pharisees come to Jesus and say, you know, Jesus, can we divorce our wives for any or every reason? And there is a back and forth conversation in which Jesus quotes from Genesis. And I can't kind of go into all the details of this, but then at the end, Jesus says, there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs. There are eunuchs who are eunuchs from birth. And there are some of you who will become eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. So this kingdom of heaven, this alternative, I guess, empire, which comes in contrast to the Roman Empire, one that is non-violent, non-hierarchical, where all are equal, all are servants, you know, these kind of categories in which the patriarchal, hierarchical kingdom of Rome has kind of set up in that first century where the Gospels are written and lived and where Jesus lived.
So they're imagining a different way of living to what was around them.
Yeah. I think that is to embody this alternative kingdom in which Jesus comes to bring in, to instill and asks disciples to follow him into. Mm. And so in this conversation, you know, Jesus is referencing this alternative way of being and doing in the world, and responds to a question which I think, you know, I interpret as being a confirmation or an expression of the patriarchy. You know, men ask, can we divorce our wives for any or every reason? How much control does the law give us over wives in our household? It was a very patriarchal society in which men at the top of that household, the paterfamilias, were the master of the household and essentially had kind of control over everyone there. Kind of they held the rights to everyone. And so I really see this question as one that is about gender. It's about patriarchy. It's about the gender norms which underpin a world in which men have absolute control and rights over women in their household, where women aren't given the same amounts of rights. And then when Jesus responds with this message about actually some of you will become like eunuchs, I think eunuchs are very much gendered in lots of ambiguous ways. They're
yes,
men.
Why do you latch on to the word eunuch? It's, I don't know, a bit violent.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, the eunuch that was made is essentially this slave trade of men who were castrated and sold into slavery and or sexually exploited. Like it's a harsh thing.
Yes.
But if we look at how they are gendered within their social worlds, they're often gendered in very, very different ways and ambiguous ways, as you know, Aristotle says, from changing from male to female, that, you know, sometimes they're neither male nor female. Sometimes they are not even human altogether, or they're non-men or un-men. There's all these kinds of weird gendered ways that people talk about them in ancient literature when they're talking about eunuchs. So I think there is a really beautiful thing about the way that they are gendered in their society, is this gender expansive, gender ambiguous way of living. And, you know, if we read through Matthew 19, 1 to 12, just simplifying it, this call to become like eunuchs, to live outside of the patriarchy, to live outside of these strict gender norms, is to be gender expansive. And that really reads consistently with this, you know, non-violent, non-hierarchical, just version of society where people aren't distinguished by the categories of who they are. Actually, everyone is on the same level. Everyone has a gift. So that's kind of a simplified reading of that text.
Well, it's an unusual reading of that text in the context of historical Christianity, which, you know, typically people have read that and just seen it as a prohibition on divorce. Your reading goes much further than that.
That's right. And I think even in conversations about marriage and divorce, I think people really struggle to land anywhere. Like there's not really consistency in how this passage is interpreted. Some people say, oh, divorce is okay in some circumstances. Some people will say divorce is not okay at all, ever. Other people will say actually divorce is okay. You know, there are lots of different ways that the Christian tradition and particularly men have interpreted this passage. And I think I point to the fact that this conversation is the exact conversation that the Pharisees come to. Like they're trying to interpret the law, like how much can we divorce our wives? Like how often can we divorce our wives? And I actually think this misses the whole point of the passage, is actually there's a critique here against the underlying views that lead men to actually even ask this question in the beginning. Like, can't you kind of hear how harsh that is against women? You know, think more deeply about, you know, how God designed the world, and I kind of do a reading of you know, calling on Genesis and this gender expansive way of reading gender, and the fact that, you know, God didn't separate and distinguish men and women to be so different. They're actually very similar and equal. That's what that story is about. And so Jesus is calling them back to these more fundamental views of gender than what their social world has socialized them to believe about gender. And I think we are being invited into that same challenge today to say, like, you know, we are socialized by these big norms and narratives about who you can be. A man is strong and dominant and leads. A woman is soft and passive and serves. Think more deeply about humanity and move beyond those for the sake of this movement of the divine into the world.
You also argue that trans people have something unique to offer to Christian theology, that it is necessary to even understand God. Well, how does that work?
Yeah, I think on two levels, you know, we currently in Australia have an epidemic of violence against women. It's it's gendered violence that is happening across the globe. We have a problem with gender. You know, it is hurting so many, not just women, though they do bear the brunt of it. I think men are told that they can't seek help. They have to kind of always be this strong person, and they have the largest amounts of suicides in Australia, a large portion, 74% of suicides. And queer and trans people are being stigmatized across the globe. You know, we have Trans Day of Remembrance to acknowledge, you know, the fact that trans people get murdered for being themselves by walking on the streets. We have laws, this kind of advancement of laws to erase our identities and exclude us. I think these are the ways that agenda, you know, views of the gender being binary work out in real life. And I do think that God sees this problem in the world and comes to respond to it by saying, actually, become like people who don't conform to these norms, because they're so harsh, they're discriminating against so many people and causing so much violence and harm. And so that's the role, and where I think trans people and gender expansive people are so special in the story of God, is that they reveal this way that doesn't subscribe to these gender norms. They actually invite us to think beyond these boxes and these ways that, you know, a lot of us find really harmful. And if you think about your own experience, you can probably, you know, think about the way those norms have been harmful to you. And then also kind of how I referenced before, I do think that this God who is behind the scenes of creating this world is one who is beyond any category. You know, God comes near and yet is immanent and transcendent. You know, that God seems to be two things at once, to kind of go beyond boxes. And I think trans and gender expansive people can show us how that, like, what that looks like as a lived reality. Like, oh, you know, you think you can't be both at the same time? Well, like, here I am, like, I'm showing you how to do that. So yeah, so I think those are the two ways that I think trans people reveal divinity to us.
Tell me about the experiences of trans people outside the church. What are the main things facing trans folks, you know, in Australia or overseas?
Firstly, I think the US is really driving a lot of this, though. I think in probably half the countries across the globe, it's illegal to be trans still. I think this is the remnants of this colonial history of the way that the gender binary has been put on across many communities across the globe. So, you know, for starters, you know, I can't travel to many countries as a trans person. You know, that's just something. But then the US has been, and, you know, in the UK as well, we see this movement, you know, maybe in the kind of more kind of Western space, against even being able to self-determine who you are. So, you know, Trump in his second day, in his second office, said, what you're assigned at birth, male or female, that's who you are. You can't say that you're anything else. And I find that really scary, that, you know, to legislate against actually telling someone, hey, this is who I am, that seems like a real overreach of the state. I think then that is going into denying people to then affirm who they are or live out who they are in all kinds of spaces. So denial to healthcare, to bathrooms in public, to playing in sport to all kinds of spaces. And, these rights are just being removed and removed and removed, and you might have some additions to that.
Yeah, well, a lot of these changes are being driven by self-avowed Christian nationalists. Like, how does that make you feel as a Christian person?
I think that's why I wrote this book, is because I had to channel this somehow. It felt so harsh, and I needed to have a voice into this space to say, actually, Christianity is being used in the wrong way. It should be being used to affirm and celebrate gender expansive people, trans and gender diverse people, rather than exclude them. And I also think we are being scapegoated because so much of this gendered harm that I've just spoken to before around gender inequality, discrimination, gendered violence, that's happening in churches, but we're not pointing over here to say, actually, this is the gender problem. We're saying trans people are the gender problem. And that in itself is just too off for me.
You were talking earlier about, that different way of living that is in opposition to kind of the norms that were described, whether it's in the Roman Empire or around today. Can you just unpack a little more? What are your hopes for yourself and for other trans people in the church?
Yeah, I think firstly, this attack on trans rights across the world, it's just to simply exist as we are in the world, that there are lots of ways that we're being excluded from doing that. And one of those is in faith. And so I say, what good could happen if we just decided to hit pause on how fierce Christians are going against LGBTQ+ people, and particularly trans and gender diverse people? I think then it would just give a breather. It's a harsh world out there where the world isn't designed for us. And so I think maybe redirecting our attention somewhere else would be great. And even if it's not just acceptance or celebration, like, you don't have to celebrate me, just stop antagonizing me and listen for a moment. I think just kind of adjusting the way that we see trans people and how targeted we are against them right now. I think that's the one thing that just feels so harsh in the world, is just every day feels like an attack against us and existing in the world, and particularly from people within my faith who are meant to be my family.
Hmm. And what's next for you personally? What are you working on?
I am actually trying to also write about how, in this book I talk a little bit about it, but I also think that that my gender identity has given me a skill that I don't think a lot of us are taught, which is how to actually cope with when things aren't certain and when things aren't fixed, how to kind of just accept things when they might not make sense or two things might be true at the same time, I think just kind of leaning more into being trans, essentially. Mm. But also, I am really passionate about people having spaces, particularly trans and queer people who haven't found a space for themselves in a faith space and are still have something lingering where I still keep thinking about God or about, that community, or there's something just niggling at me and I haven't had a space really to explore that. I really feel really passionate about opening up spaces for people to just safely explore, sometimes in the queer spaces, we can often lose that part of centralizing faith and spirituality because it has been such a harmful tool against us. And I really do love bringing these intersections together. So I guess I want to create spaces for that online, in person. What does my faith and spirituality look like? What do I want it to be? What am I still doing out of obligation, or I feel like I should be doing, and what do I want to let go of? I think those are really beautiful, sacred, transformative spaces.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's been a real pleasure, Steph.
Thanks so much, Rowan. It's been so lovely to be part of it. Thanks for inviting me on.
Steph Fenton is queer, trans, non-binary, and Christian. Their book is called Gender Expansive Faith: How Trans Lives Are Illuminating the Divine, Transforming Feminism, and Ending Christian Patriarchy. There's more information about Steph and their work on the Soul Search website. Don't forget, you can also email me at soul.search@abc.net.au. This episode of Soul Search was produced on Gadigal land. Big thanks to executive producer Noel DeBeer. I'm Rowan Salmond, and I'm looking forward to your company next time for Soul Search on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.